Maybe, you know, again, an aside, not related to anything. So I mentioned this space of this space A of the empty set, and sort of everything that followed was more or less useless. So it's sort of cute and has to do with the four-color theorem, but it's more or less useless. The space A of the empty set actually does occur in nature. So one can show that this is two, it is related to three manifold invariants, some class of three manifolds at least, a pretty general class of three manifolds, in the same way that A of a circle is related to knots. So there is a certain theory of finite type invariants of three manifolds for which the space of weight systems is the space of linear functionals on A of the empty set. So hence people are interested in A of the empty set as well as in A of the circle. Okay? Now, yeah, I'm not planning of saying anything about this, other than saying that the subject exists. Okay? So now I want to go back to the main stream, and there are two more things that I want to do several more things that I want to do about this concept, that I want to state about this construction. So first of all, there is also an index-free way to restate this construction, and sort of, you know, if you do it this way, it becomes clear that that it's independent of the choice of basis. On the other hand, you know, it doesn't make it any easier to do any actual computations. Okay? And basically, well, you just go more abstract everywhere. Okay? So, so again, given a Lie algebra, a metric and a representation, you can view, you can replace all these sort of tensors with indices by abstract tensors. So the bracket of the Lie algebra is something that takes two elements of the Lie algebra and outputs a single element of the Lie algebra. So that's a tensor in G dual, tensor G dual, tensor G dual, tensor G. Right? So if you had an element of this tensor product, it could be viewed as a map from G tensor G into G. Okay, this is, if you want, home of G tensor G, comma G. So the bracket is just an element of this tensor space. Okay? Likewise, or you know what, let's even call it the bracket, not F. Okay? Likewise, T is an element of G dual tensor G dual, because it eats two elements of G and outputs a number. Okay? So it's dual to G tensor G. So it's in G dual tensor G dual. Okay? Everything is finite dimensional, so there's no issues with duality. Okay? And to be more precise, it's a symmetric element, so it's in the symmetric tensor power of second tensor power of G dual. Okay? Furthermore, it is invariant. To be invariant means, sorry, not invariant, it is non-degenerate. To be non-degenerate means that there exists T inverse, inside G tensor G, which is the inverse of T. Meaning that if you look at T tensor T inverse, well, this would be an element in, well, T lives in T dual, G dual tensor G dual tensor G tensor G. And then you contract these two factors, right? Do I need to say what it means? I mean, I don't know how much linear algebra I'm allowed to assume. So if you contract two factors, means just that, or, you know, in general, if you have W tensor X dual, then the general element here is of the form sum of W tensor lowercase x tensor phi, where W belongs to the big W, X belongs to X, and phi belongs to X dual. And then there is a map from here into, the map is called contracting, so you contract these two elements, there is a map into W, and it is defined by mapping this into sum of, well, you evaluate the phi on the X. So W times phi evaluated on X. Okay? So you apply this contraction map and you get an element in G dual tensor G, but G dual tensor G is just the homomorphisms of G into itself. Okay, so what I want is that you will get the identity. So I want this to map into the identity which lives here.
So the first there, the T tensor T inverse is not equal to...
It's not equal, it's in. Yes. Okay? So the fact that T is non-degenerate is the statement that there exists a T-inverse in G tensor G with this property, okay? Now you can do a similar thing to B. So basically, you have G tensor, G dual tensor, G dual tensor G. This is where B lives, so B lives here. And then you can tensor it with where T lives. So B tensor T will live in this tensor G dual. And then you can contract, I suppose, this pair. So you can contract a piece of B with a piece of T. To get, right, this is exactly what is done over here. It's exactly this. So you get an element in G dual tensor cubed, and let's declare that this element is called F. Okay? And in fact, to be more precise, it's equal to the third antisymmetric power of, or rather, it's inside the third antisymmetric power of G dual. Okay. And finally, the representation is something that eats one element in the Lie algebra, so it has a G star factor, and outputs a homomorphism or an endomorphism of R. An endomorphism in R takes an element of R, so it has an R star factor, and outputs an element of R, so it has an R factor as well. Okay, so R can be regarded as an element here. Okay? And now, if I have a big diagram, what I do is, well, first of all, I break it in pieces. Okay, so it becomes this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece, and that piece. Okay? And I replace each piece by the corresponding abstract tensor. So internal lines become T-inverses, vertices becomes copies of F, and skeleton vertices become copies of R. So I put a copy of R here, I put a copy of R here, a copy of R here, a copy of F here, a T-inverse here, a T-inverse here, a T-inverse here. Okay? And so, you know, if you wanted to write it linearly along a long line, this would be a big tensor product of F tensor, T inverse tensor, T inverse tensor, T inverse tensor, R tensor, R tensor, R, living in, well, okay, the F lives in G-dual tensor, G-dual tensor, G-dual. The T-inverse lives in G tensor G. The second T-inverse lives in G tensor G, and so on. Okay? But rather than writing it linearly, it's nicer to just mark the spaces on the diagram. So F lives in G dual tensor G dual tensor G dual. T inverse lives in G tensor G. R lives in G dual tensor R dual tensor R. This R lives in R dual tensor R. This tensor G dual. This T inverse lives in G tensor G, and so on. Okay? And now, gluing back the diagram, gluing it back together to get the diagram where you started from, let's do it in by adding purple lines. So each purple line connects a space and its dual, so you can interpret it as a contraction. Okay? So there is a certain big purple contraction map. Okay? And when you do this big contraction map, all the spaces are paired. So nothing remains. So it goes into Q, or the ground field. And that's it. That's what I wanted. Okay? I started from a big tensor in a big tensor space, contracted it down to Q, and the specification of how to contract it is the diagram. Okay? And, you know, I don't know if you like it better or not. It's more abstract. No need to choose a basis. It's up to your judgment whether you like it better or not. Second, let's take a little break. Sorry, that's as good a time as any. So I was asked by the powers of the department to pass a participation sheet. So please pass it around and sign it. You have to sign your name, indicate your status, and this is the tricky part because I actually know that there are people watching these videos outside, so I want them to send me an email with this information so that I can add them. So the status can be an undergrad, a grad, a postdoctoral fellow, a faculty, a visitor, or, I don't know, an outsider, if you're watching it from the outside. And you should indicate if you're taking this class for credit or not. So again, if you're watching it from the outside, please send me an email with this information. And let's do it, and I'll pass this sheet again on Thursday just to make sure that everybody who is sometimes present will sign it. Okay, and now back to class material. So, and one more thing that I want to state about this is that there is a way of doing it without ever choosing a representation, and in some sense it's a better way. Okay? So I want to tell you about this. So definition. Definition. Given a Lie algebra calligraphic G, the universal enveloping algebra of G is, well, there are various abstract definitions of the universal enveloping algebra, but I don't want to go abstract, I want to be completely concrete. So in fact, in some sense, I'm not defining the universal enveloping algebra, I'm constructing it. Okay? So it's called U of G, and it's the algebra of words with letters in G. Okay? So, modulo linearity in the letters. And I'm not done defining it yet. So, this part is actually often called the tensor algebra of G. And so far I didn't even use the fact that G is a Lie algebra, so this makes sense for an arbitrary vector space. Okay? So what it is just so just to understand what it is, these are words of the form, these are so the elements of U of G or the elements of T of G are words of the form A, B, C, D, okay, where each letter is an element of the Lie algebra, except we mod out by linearity in all of the words. So we declare that the word A, B1 plus B2, C, D is equal to the word A, B1, C, D, plus the word A, B2, C, D. Okay? And likewise, A, and then 3 times B, times C, D, is declared to be equal to 3 times A, B, C, D. Okay? So is it clear? Okay? And I also allow the empty word, and I should have said that this is an algebra because you can concatenate words, so it's algebra by concatenation of words, so you turn words into sentences if you wish, and with this multiplication, the empty word is just the unit of the algebra, okay? Because you add the empty word to anything, you get the thing you started from. Okay? So this can be done to an arbitrary vector space. You can turn an arbitrary vector space into an algebra by just allowing words in the vector space. Okay? Now, in the case of a Lie algebra, or if you can construct the so-called universal enveloping algebra by modding out by one further relation, and the further relation, or more precisely by the ideal generated by a further relation, And the further relation is the relation which says that x bracket y is equal to x times y minus y times x. But again, what does it mean? So this is a one-letter word. One-letter word. So I start from two elements in the Lie algebra, and then their bracket is again an element of the Lie algebra, so it's a single letter. And what I'm asserting, or the relation that I mod out by, is the relation which says that this one-letter word is equal to the two-letter word xy minus the two-letter word yx. So this is a difference of two-letter words. Okay? So is the definition clear? Are you happy? Is the definition clear? Okay, good. So it's a pretty large space in general. Okay? Let me, without giving you a detailed proof, let me state the PBW theorem. And the PBW theorem at least gives you a measure of how big this space is. Okay? So PBW actually also valid in for infinite dimensional Lie algebras, but I don't want to bother with this. So just choose an ordered basis of the Lie algebra. Then the claim is that the universal enveloping algebra of G is equal as a vector space to the set of linear combinations of monotone non-decreasing words in our basis, x1 up to xn, mod no relations. Well, sorry. Mod no relations. Okay? For example, if the Lie algebra was three-dimensional, so say it was the Lie algebra SO3, which is generated by three generators, x, y, and z, with brackets that we've already indicated. Okay, so the bracket of x with y is z, and cyclically continued. Okay, so the bracket of y with z is x, the bracket of z with x is y. Okay, but anyway, the claim will be that the universal enveloping algebra of G, of this G, is as a linear space, as a vector space, equal to the space of all linear combinations of words in which X appears first, and then Y, and then Z. So you'll have a number of X, so it's the set of all linear combinations of things that look like a number of x's, right? Because I said non-decreasing, I didn't say strictly increasing. So you'll have a number of x's, and then a number of y's, and then a number of z's. Okay? So altogether, if you wish, it's the space of all linear it's the space of all linear combinations of words of the form x to the power n1, y to the power n2, z to the power n3. Okay? And so I said that it makes sense in infinite dimensions. It clearly makes sense in infinite dimensions as well. You just choose an ordered basis and put the exact same condition. Okay? So this sort of gives you a sense for the size of the of the universal enveloping algebra. Okay? So if the algebra was three-dimensional, then the universal enveloping algebra looks like polynomials in three variables. If it was five-dimensional, it would look like polynomials in five variables, except this is only true as a vector space. It's not true as an algebra. Okay, so the multiplication rule is not just the multiplication rules of commuting polynomials, because you have some, you know, when you try to commute two things across each other, you pay a certain price. Okay? So I don't want to prove the PBW theorem. The proof appears in many textbooks. But I do want to sketch the proof of the PBW theorem. And sort of basically, the theorem looks so clear at first that it's worth sketching the proof just so that you see where it, where the tricky point in it is. Okay? So, proof, so, or sketch of the proof. So, the naive thought is that it's obvious. Okay, so you have an arbitrary word, a1, a2, a3, up to an. This is a word in with letters in the Lie algebra. You inspect this word, and you ask yourself if it is non-decreasing. Okay, so you go through it, and maybe a2 was bigger than a1, so you're happy. And maybe a3 was equal to a2, so you're happy. But at some point, you're going, you may find, well, if you go all the way through and it's non-decreasing, you're just happy. But if at some point you find a pair of words, of letters, which are ordered incorrectly, so a4 is less than a3, then you want to rewrite this whole thing using the things which are, I'm claiming are a basis, but make a basis. But it's obvious that you can do it, because you can replace a4 by a3, and the price that you pay is a word with one letter less. Okay? So in other words, this is equal to a1, a2, a4, a3, and so on. And now this is a correctly ordered word. But you have to pay a price, because the difference between these two is something like a1, a2, and then the bracket of a3 and a4. And to be honest, it's a plus minus. I mean, it's either a plus or a minus, but I don't know which one. I don't want to think which one it is. Okay? And so on. And this is a word with one letter less. So n minus one letters. And by induction, we've already dealt with these words yesterday. So we don't have to deal with them now. Okay? So the conclusion is that so-called PBW words. So let's declare that words of this kind are called PBW words. So these are non-decreasing words in the basis elements. So the conclusion is that PBW words generate. Okay, and so far the theorem looks obvious. Okay, the problem is that it's not obvious that this procedure is well defined. In other words, suppose you had a combination ZYX, then you'll want to sort it. So you'll want to sort it, and when you sort it, it will become XYZ plus lower order or terms or plus shorter words. Okay? And, but what is not clear is that the combination of shorter words that you will get here is well defined. In other words, there are two ways of sorting this combination. You could either first flip the x, the z and the y, so you get z, y, x, and then flip the z and the x, and you'll get y, z, x, and now you flip the z and the x, so you get y, x, z, and then flip the x and the y, so you'll get x, y, z, okay? And every time you flip, you pay a price. So you pay price number one, price number two, and price number three, and those prices are in term of shorter words, okay? But I could also order it, I could also rearrange them to be increasing by first flipping y and x. So I'll go to z times x, y, and then flipping x and z, so I'll get x times z times y, and then I could flip z and y, and I'll get x, y, z. So I go to the same answer, but I paid potentially different prices, P4, P5, P6. So the procedure of sorting, or in other words, the rewriting of a word in terms of ordered words, which are in the PBW, which are PBW words, okay? So the this procedure is well defined if you can show that P1 plus P2 plus P3 is equal to P4 plus P5 plus P6. And that's not obvious. Okay? So, as I said, I'm only sketching the proof. And what you will do is you write the prices explicitly. Okay? And so you write what P1 and P2 and P3 are explicitly. You write all the prices explicitly and you ask yourself, are the two things in the two sides equal? And they turn out that it turns out that they are equal by the Jacobi identity. Okay? So what makes this procedure well defined is the Jacobi identity. So far I didn't need to use it. So, you know, if you look at the PBW theorem naively, it's not clear why I need G to be a Lie algebra. I could have used any other, any other bracket.
It has to be anti-symmetric.
And the place, what?
Anti-symmetric. You also need anti-symmetric.
Sorry, I also need anti-symmetric. But there are many brackets that are anti-symmetric that do not satisfy the Jacobi identity. So, basically take any product you want on any algebra and anti-symmetrize it. And then you get an anti-symmetric product, and no reason in the world why it would satisfy the Jacobi identity. So the statement that PBW words generate is general. It will work even if G is not a Lie algebra, okay? But the fact that there are no further relations, so the map into PBW words is well defined, when you trace, when you go through it, you find that you need to use the Jacobi identity. Okay? So it really is a theorem about Lie algebras. Okay. Anyway, so I think we have a feel for what the universal enveloping algebra is. Again, if the Lie algebra is seven-dimensional, then this is more or less like polynomials in seven variables, except it's not as a vector space, not as an algebra. The product is just a, well, a different product. Okay. So claim. So claim, well, if you start from A, and this time it's better to use the version of A where you think of the skeleton as being a single line, and suppose that you choose a Lie algebra G, and I suppose it still has to be metrized, so with a metric T, then you get automatically a map, which I will call T of G, into the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra. Okay? And sort of the meaning of this statement is that, well, that I'm about to define the map T of G and that it will satisfy the STU and IHX and antisymmetry relations. Okay? And furthermore, if you are also given a representation R, then you can construct a map from the universal enveloping algebra into the ground field called the trace in that representation, or maybe the character of that representation, which makes this diagram commutative when you put here the construction from before. Okay? So I guess I need to tell you what these two things are. But it's kind of obvious. So first of all, let's talk about T of G. So T of G is as follows. Suppose you have a diagram with a skeleton, a line. Okay? So you ignore the skeleton in the construction that is written here, okay? So, or not quite ignore, you treat it in a different way. So you label as before A, B, C, C prime, D, D prime, E, E prime. And this will go to, just like before, you write T, A, B, T, C, C prime, T, D, D prime, T, E, E prime, and then you put the Fs as expected, so F, C, D, E, and then down here you just write the corresponding basis elements of the Lie algebra. So this will be X sub A, X sub C prime, X sub B, X sub D prime, X sub E prime. So you put here X and you write them in the order in which they appear along the skeleton. So it's X A x c prime x b x d prime x e prime. And in this expression, once again, every English letter appears twice. So you just use the Einstein summation convention. So I mean, you just sum. All the summations here are summations that go from one to the dimension of the Lie algebra. No representation was ever chosen. And the thing that you get will be, well, coefficients times things that can be interpreted as words in the universal enveloping algebra. So this is just an element in the universal enveloping algebra. It's a linear combination of words. Okay? Now you have to verify that all the relations are satisfied. So the anti-symmetry relation was internal. We didn't touch the internals. We still are using the structure constants for the vertices. So they're still anti-symmetric. The IHX relation was internal, again, and we didn't touch the internals, so it still satisfies IHX. The only thing to verify is to check that it satisfies STU. So let's just check what STU goes to. So, sorry, STU is this, is equal to this minus that, but it's clear what it goes to, right? This is a short for the bracket. This is the output of the bracket regarded as an element of the universal enveloping algebra. So this will be the bracket of two things is equal to, well, here you multiply the two things in one order in the universal enveloping algebra, and here you multiply them in the other order. So xy minus yx, and this is the defining relation of the universal enveloping algebra. Okay, so the STU becomes the defining relation of U of G. Okay, so it's kind of easy. Now I have to tell you about the map from here to here, but it's also easy. So given a representation, so given rho, which is in a Lie algebra map from the Lie algebra into the endomorphisms of a vector space, you can, well, extend it to a map also called rho, which is a map from the universal enveloping algebra into the endomorphism of the same vector space. Namely, you just map every word x, y, z into rho of x, rho of y, rho of z. So this was a product in the universal enveloping algebra, and it becomes a product of matrices, if you wish. Okay? But the defining relation of the universal enveloping algebra becomes the fact that representations are representations. Okay, so xy equals xy minus yx becomes rho of the bracket is equal to the bracket of the rows. Okay, so this is well defined. And then just define trace in the representation to be a trace composed with rho. So whenever you have an endomorphism, you have a trace. And the fact that this commutes is left as an exercise. Okay? And, ooh, time to quit. I'll just tell you what I still owe you. So part of the point, so we're deep in the low algebra world, okay? But part of the point is that the universal enveloping algebra has many further algebraic properties. It's an algebra, as I stated. but it's also a co-algebra. It has a PBW theorem. It has a nice behavior relative to taking the direct sum of Lie algebras. So it has various known algebraic properties. And now I want to go backwards and see these algebraic properties as properties of A, and sometimes even further back, and see these algebraic properties as properties of K. So I want to go back to combinatorics and then to topology, at least in a limited way. So, but this will happen next time. So thank you.